A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel wrote in with a question about where the world's money actually lives. Not the money in checking accounts or under mattresses. The vast institutional pools. Pensions. Sovereign wealth funds. Insurers. Mutual funds. Private equity. Hedge funds. Endowments. He wants to know which categories are largest, and by roughly how much, how their asset mixes differ, and how the whole picture has shifted over the last 20 or 30 years. He's explicitly not after false precision, order of magnitude, credible scale. And I appreciate that framing because these numbers are slippery and every source uses a different methodology.
They really are. And the first number is the one that reliably makes people blink. Global pension assets sit around $56 to $63 trillion. That's the single largest pool of managed capital on Earth. Bigger than sovereign wealth funds by a factor of 4 or 5. Bigger than the entire private equity industry several times over. Pensions are the quiet giant nobody talks about at dinner parties.
Because nobody under 45 believes they'll ever see a pension.
That's not unrelated. But the scale is staggering. You've got pensions at roughly 60 trillion plus. Then mutual funds and the big asset managers. BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, and everyone else. That's over 70 trillion in global assets under management. But they're a different animal. They're vehicles, not owners. The assets belong to the people who bought the funds. Still, as a concentration of managed capital, that's the other enormous pool.
So pensions at 60, mutual funds at 70. What's next?
Insurance companies. About 40 trillion globally. This is the pool nobody ever thinks about, but they're the backbone of the bond market. Then you drop down to sovereign wealth funds, roughly 13 trillion combined. Private equity and private credit together, maybe 15 trillion plus. Hedge funds, 4 to 5 trillion. Endowments and family offices are smaller individually but growing fast. Maybe a couple trillion each, depending how you count.
And banks.
Banks hold deposits. That's not managed capital in the same sense. The deposits are liabilities to the bank, and the bank's own investment portfolio is much smaller. The money that actually drives markets, that allocates across asset classes, that sets prices at the margin, that's in the pools we're talking about.
So the hierarchy is mutual funds at the top, then pensions, then insurers, then sovereign funds and private markets roughly tied, then hedge funds bringing up the rear. That's not the story most people carry around in their heads.
It's not. Most people think sovereign wealth funds are the biggest game in town because they make headlines. Norway buying up real estate in Tokyo, the Saudis investing in sports leagues. And hedge funds have this mystique from the 90s and 2000s, but the boring money, the retirement money, the insurance premiums, that's where the real mass is.
Let's get inside these pools then. What are they actually holding?
They look completely different from each other, and the reason is liability matching. A pension fund has promised to pay retirees 30 years from now. An insurance company has policyholder obligations that might stretch out 50 years. A sovereign wealth fund has nothing, no liabilities in the conventional sense. It's just a pile of national savings.
So the Norwegian fund can be 70% equities, because nobody's coming for a payout next Tuesday.
Norway's government pension fund global, $1.7 trillion, roughly 70% public equities, the rest in bonds and a growing real estate portfolio. Very transparent, very rules-based. Compare that to a typical insurance company balance sheet, 60 to 70% bonds, because they need to match those long-duration liabilities with predictable fixed income. Equities are maybe 10 to 15%. The rest is real estate, mortgages, some private placements.
And pensions sit somewhere in the middle.
Right. A large public pension fund like CalPERS, about $500 billion, might be 40 to 50% public equities, 25 to 30% fixed income, and the rest in private equity, real estate, and other alternatives. But that mix has been moving. In 2010, CalPERS had about 7% in private equity, Today, it's over 13%. And that shift is the single biggest story in institutional investing over the past 15 years.
The chase for yield.
Post-2008, central banks crushed interest rates. A pension fund that needed 7% annual returns to meet its obligations looked at the bond market yielding 2% and said, well, they said we have a problem. The only place to find the returns they needed was private markets. Private equity, private credit, infrastructure, real estate. So they moved, slowly at first, then all at once.
And there's a mechanical effect that made it worse.
The denominator effect. When public equities drop, like they did in 2022, the total value of the portfolio shrinks. But the private equity holdings don't get marked down as quickly or as deeply. So suddenly, your private allocation looks bigger as a percentage of the total, even though you didn't buy anything new. Funds that were targeting 13% private equity found themselves at 16 or 17% overnight.
Which then makes them pull back on new commitments, which creates a whole secondary dynamic.
Yes. And that's where the dry powder comes in. Private equity funds are sitting on something like $2.5 trillion in uninvested capital right now, record levels. That's capital that's been committed by pensions and sovereign funds and insurers, but the general partners haven't deployed it yet. It's parked. Waiting.
$2.5 trillion in dry powder. That's larger than the entire hedge fund industry was 15 years ago.
Which brings us to hedge funds. 4 to 5 trillion in assets under management, and that number has been basically flat for a decade. Meanwhile, private equity has gone from maybe 1 to 2 trillion in the early 2000s to 8 to 10 trillion today. Private credit alone is now 1.5 to 2 trillion, and that category barely existed in 2008.
What happened to hedge funds?
Fees, mostly. The 2-in-20 model, 2% management fee, 20% of profits, worked when they were generating outsized returns. But post-2008, hedge fund returns have been fine. Not terrible, but not worth 2-in-20 when you can get beta from an index fund for 4 basis points. The smart money that used to go to hedge funds has been flowing into private markets instead. Longer lockups, higher returns, more control.
So private equity ate hedge funds' lunch.
And private credit ate the bank's lunch. Post-2008 regulation made it expensive for banks to hold risky loans on their balance sheets. Private credit funds stepped into that gap. Direct lending to mid-market companies, real estate bridge financing, distressed debt. The returns have been attractive, and the institutional pools have been pouring capital in.
Let's step back to the 30-year picture. What did this landscape look like in the mid-90s?
Radically different. Pensions were even more dominant then, especially US and UK corporate pensions. Sovereign wealth funds were a rounding error, basically Kuwait, Abu Dhabi, and Singapore. The Norwegian fund didn't start receiving oil revenue until 1996. The Chinese funds didn't exist. Private equity was tiny, a few hundred billion at most, and it was still called leveraged buyouts half the time.
And the geography was completely different.
Entirely. In 1995, if you listed the world's 20 largest pension funds, they were almost all in the US, the UK, Canada, the Netherlands, and Japan. Today, Japan's GPIF alone is about $1.5 trillion. In 2001, it was roughly $100 billion. That's 15 times growth in 2 decades. Korea's National Pension Service has gone from almost nothing to over $800 billion. China's social security funds have accumulated trillions.
And the Gulf sovereign wealth funds have transformed.
ADIA, the Abu Dhabi Investment Authority, has been around since 1976, but its scale today is completely different. The Saudi Public Investment Fund didn't really register on global markets until the last decade. Now it's over $700 billion and growing fast. Investing in everything from Uber to LIV Golf. Qatar's Investment Authority, Kuwait's fund, the UAE's various vehicles, these are now major global allocators.
And their investment style has changed too.
Dramatically. 20 years ago, Gulf sovereign funds were conservative, mostly bonds, some public equities, maybe a few trophy real estate assets in London. Today, they're aggressive dealmakers. Direct investments in tech companies, massive infrastructure plays, sports franchises, entertainment. They're not just parking oil revenues anymore. They're trying to diversify their economies and build global influence.
The shift east is real then.
It's undeniable. And it's not just sovereign funds. The Asian pension giants, Japan's GPIF, Korea's NPS, China's funds, have become enormous. The center of gravity of global institutional capital is moving. 20 years ago, a company looking for a large institutional investor would fly to New York, Boston, or London. Today, they're also flying to Tokyo, Seoul, Abu Dhabi, Riyadh, Beijing.
What about the concentration question? How much of this capital is controlled by a small number of institutions?
It's highly concentrated. The top 20 pension funds control a huge share of total pension assets. The top 10 sovereign wealth funds account for something like 80 or 90% of all sovereign fund assets. A few hundred institutions. The CalPERS of the world, the GPIFs, the Norwegian Fund, BlackRock and Vanguard, the big insurers like Prudential and Allianz. These are the ones that effectively allocate the world's institutional capital.
And that concentration has implications.
It does. When a handful of institutions all move in the same direction, all increasing private equity allocations, all adding infrastructure, all pulling back from public equities, they move markets. They become the marginal price setters. This is especially true in private markets, where there's no public exchange providing continuous price discovery. The price of a private company, a real estate portfolio, an infrastructure asset, that's being set by the few dozen large allocators who are active in that space.
Which raises a question about systemic risk. We've moved a lot of capital from public markets, which are transparent and liquid, into private markets, which are neither.
That's the trade. The institutions got higher returns in exchange for giving up liquidity. And in normal times, that's fine. A pension fund with a 30-year horizon doesn't need daily liquidity. But in a crisis, if everyone needs to sell and the private assets can't be sold without taking a huge haircut, that's the scenario the regulators worry about.
Has that been tested?
Partially. In 2020, during the COVID crash, some pension funds faced capital calls from their private equity commitments at the exact moment their public portfolios were in freefall. They had to sell public assets at distressed prices to meet commitments to private funds. That's the liquidity mismatch in action. It didn't cause a systemic crisis, but it was a warning shot.
And the private equity funds themselves are sitting on those $2.5 trillion in dry powder you mentioned. That's a statement about where we're in the cycle.
It's a statement about a lot of things. Part of it's that deals have been harder to do at attractive prices with interest rates higher. Part of it's that the funds raised enormous amounts of capital in the low-rate era and haven't been able to deploy it fast enough. And part of it's that the exit environment, taking companies public or selling them, has been challenging. So the capital sits there, committed but uninvested, earning nothing for the limited partners.
The limited partners being the pensions and sovereign funds and insurers we've been talking about.
They've promised this money to private equity funds, and it's just waiting. Meanwhile, they're paying fees on committed capital in many cases. It's not a great deal for them right now.
Let's talk about mutual funds and the asset managers. You said over 70 trillion. That's the biggest number on the board, but they're a different kind of pool.
They are. When we talk about BlackRock managing $10 trillion, that's not BlackRock's money. It's the money of millions of retail investors, 401(k)-1(k)-holders, holders, ETF buyers, and institutional clients. BlackRock is the steward, not the owner. But as a steward, they have enormous influence, proxy voting, engagement with companies, the decisions about what goes into their indexes.
And the shift from active to passive has concentrated that influence.
Massively. 40 years ago, most mutual fund assets were in actively managed funds, stock pickers. Today, passive funds and ETFs account for more than half of all mutual fund assets. And the big three, BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, dominate passive. So you have this strange situation where a tiny number of institutions vote a huge percentage of the shares at most major public companies.
Which is a different kind of concentration than the one we were talking about with pensions.
It is. Pensions concentrate capital. The big asset managers concentrate voting power. Different mechanism, similar result. A small number of entities have outsized influence over global capital allocation.
What about the asset mix in mutual funds? How does it compare to pensions?
It varies enormously by fund type, but in aggregate, mutual funds are heavily weighted toward public equities and bonds. That's what they're designed for. They don't do much private equity or direct real estate because those assets don't fit the daily liquidity structure of a mutual fund. That's actually a big part of why private markets have grown so much. The mutual fund structure can't easily accommodate illiquid assets, so the capital that wants those assets has to go elsewhere.
So the growth of private markets is partly a regulatory and structural story, not just a return-chasing story.
Yes. The 1940 Investment Company Act in the U.S. effectively limits how much illiquid exposure a mutual fund can have. Pensions and sovereign funds don't face those same constraints. So as the appetite for private assets has grown, the capital has flowed to the vehicles that can actually hold them.
What about endowments and family offices? You said they're smaller, but growing.
Endowments. Think Yale, Harvard, Stanford. Collectively manage maybe $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion. Small relative to the giants, but influential because the Yale model pioneered by David Swensen showed everyone else how to allocate to private markets. The top endowments have been in private equity and venture capital for decades, and their returns have been spectacular. That influenced the pension funds to follow.
And family offices.
Hard to measure precisely because they're private by definition, but estimates put global family office assets somewhere around 5 to 6 trillion. They've been growing fast as global wealth has concentrated. And they're increasingly behaving like institutional investors. Direct deals, co-investments, private credit. The line between a large family office and a small sovereign wealth fund is getting blurry.
So, the 30-year picture is, pensions still enormous but less dominant. Sovereign wealth funds and Asian pools have exploded. Private markets have gone from niche to mainstream. Hedge funds have stagnated. And the whole thing has shifted east and toward state-linked capital.
And toward illiquidity. That's the thread that connects everything. 30 years ago, most institutional capital was in public stocks and government bonds. Liquid, transparent, priced daily. Today, a growing share is in assets that trade rarely or never, whose prices are estimates rather than observations, and whose risks are harder to measure.
What does that mean for the next crisis?
Nobody really knows. That's the honest answer. We've never had a financial crisis with this much institutional capital locked up in private markets. The last big one, 2008, was a public market crisis. Mortgage-backed securities, bank balance sheets, interbank lending. The next one might look different. It might involve pension funds unable to meet capital calls, or a wave of private credit defaults that hits insurers, or a sovereign wealth fund blowing up on a bad direct investment.
Or all of the above.
The interconnectedness is the part that keeps me up. A pension fund in Oregon, a sovereign fund in Abu Dhabi, and an insurer in Munich might all be limited partners in the same private equity fund. If that fund gets into trouble, the losses don't stay in one place. They propagate through the limited partner base in ways that are hard to trace.
That's cheerful. Let's talk about the state capital angle. You said the shift east is towards state-linked pools.
Norway's fund is state-owned. China's funds are state-owned. The Gulf funds are state-owned. Singapore's Temasek and GIC are state-owned. Korea's NPS is a public pension fund. Japan's GPIF is public. If you add it up, a very large and growing share of global institutional capital is ultimately controlled by governments or government-linked entities.
And that's different from 30 years ago.
Very different. In 1995, the largest pools were mostly private sector corporate pensions in the US and UK, plus some public pensions. The sovereign wealth fund universe barely existed. Today, state-linked capital is probably a third or more of the total institutional pool, and growing. That has geopolitical implications that we're only starting to understand.
The Norwegians are relatively benign. Transparent, rules-based, mostly passive. But not everyone operates that way.
And even the Norwegians have an ethical council that excludes companies from their portfolio based on Norwegian foreign policy priorities. That's soft power. The Gulf funds and Chinese funds use their capital more directly. Strategic investments in technology, infrastructure, energy. They're not just seeking returns. They're seeking influence, access, and economic diversification.
So the structure of global capital is also a structure of global power.
It always has been. The Medici didn't just lend money. They shaped Renaissance politics. The difference now is the scale and the speed. A sovereign wealth fund can move billions in a week into a sector or a country and reshape the competitive landscape.
Hilbert, you've been quiet, and I have a feeling you've seen this from the inside.
Late 90s. Actuarial consultancy in Leeds. Small firm, maybe 40 people. We advised a mid-sized UK pension fund, manufacturing sector, about £3 billion in assets at the time.
What did their portfolio look like?
2% private equity. The trustees were terrified of it. They'd asked me to explain the illiquidity risk every single quarter, and I'd run the same spreadsheet model, showing them it was a footnote. The annual report listed private equity under other assets with an asterisk about valuation uncertainty. 1999.
You were the guy running those models.
I was. Lotus 123 took about 40 minutes to recalculate.
What happened to the fund?
By 2015, private markets were the largest single allocation after public equities. 15%. And when I say nobody could explain the illiquidity risk to the trustees by then, I mean nobody. The actuaries didn't understand it, the consultants didn't understand it, and the trustees had stopped asking. They just wanted the returns.
Were you still there in 2015?
No. The consultancy merged in 2001. I was laid off 3 weeks before the deal closed, right as the whole industry was about to take off.
That's brutal timing.
I kept one share of the successor company. It's worth about £40 now. Sits in a drawer. Reminder.
Of what?
That the footnote becomes the headline if you wait long enough.
The trustees who were terrified in 1999, what happened to them?
Retired mostly. Their pensions were fine. The fund's still going. I check the annual report every few years. The private equity allocation's up to 18% now. Still an asterisk somewhere in the footnotes.
Does the £40 share pay dividends?
14 pence a year. I don't cash the checks.
Of course you don't.
They're in the same drawer.
That's a hell of a footnote. Let's wrap this up.
The open question I keep coming back to is price discovery. We've moved trillions from public markets, where prices update every second and anyone can see them, into private markets where a valuation might be updated quarterly, and it's basically the fund manager's best guess. As that share grows, what happens to our ability to know what anything is actually worth? And what happens in a crisis when everyone needs to know?
The state capital dimension. The next 20 years will likely see sovereign wealth funds and Asian pensions become even more dominant. The era of state-linked capital as the primary force in global markets may just be beginning. That changes the logic of who invests, why they invest, and what they want in return.
The numbers are estimates. Every source we've cited uses different methodologies, different coverage, different definitions. But the direction is unmistakable. Capital is consolidating into fewer, larger, more patient pools. Those pools are moving east and toward state ownership. And they're locking up more of their money in assets that can't be sold quickly. That's the structure of global capital in 2026.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping us honest, and for the £40 share certificate.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It genuinely helps. You can also find every episode and the full archive at myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon. Go look up your own pension fund's private equity allocation. You might be surprised.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.